smart. She'd been thinking farther ahead than me. I could clearly see the dozens of lines and figures that had been painted onto the barge's deck, along with burning candles, incense, and the small, still remains of animal sacrifices. Mostly rabbits, cats, and dogs, it looked like. Rituals, whatever form they take, always involve the use of a circle, explicit or otherwise. The circle had to be there to contain the energy that they'd been building up with all the sacrifices, if nothing else. This one had been established invisibly, maybe originally set up with incense or something. But as the water lapped over the edge of the circle, it immediately began to disperse the pent-up energy, visible as clouds of fluttering sparks, like static that danced along the surface of the water. And for just a second, everything in the night went silent. Then there was a disturbance in the water, with more ugly green light pouring up from below the surface. Water suddenly rushed up, displaced by something moving beneath the surface, and then Shark Face exploded up from the depths, his freaky rag cloak spread out around him in an enormous cloud of tentacle-like extrusions. He turned his eyeless face toward me, exactly, not Karen, and not the Earl King, and let out a howl of fury so loud the water for 50 feet in every direction vibrated and danced in time with it. And a wave of pure, violent, blinding, nauseating pain blanketed the face of Lake Michigan. Chapter 43. Suddenly, I wasn't on the bitch seat of Karen's Harley. I was hanging, suspended in midair, and I was in agony. I opened my eyes and looked wildly around me. Barren, icy earth. Cold, gray sky. My arms and legs were stretched out into an X shape, and ice, the color of a deep blue sky, encased them, holding them stretched out against what felt like an old, knotted tree. Muscles and ligaments from my everywhere were at the trembling breaking point. My own heartbeat was torment. My face burned, exposed to cold so severe that it hurt even me. I tried to scream, but couldn't. A slow, gargling moan came out instead, and I coughed blood into the freezing air. "You knew this was coming," said a voice that still made my entire body thrum in response, something simple and elemental that did not care how long she had held me in torment. "You knew this day would come. I am what I am, as are you." Mab walked into my vision from the left. I barely had enough strength to keep my eyes focused on her. "You saw what happened to my last night," she said, and began to take slow steps closer to me. I didn't want to give her the satisfaction, but I couldn't help it. I heard myself make a soft noise, felt myself make a feeble effort to move or escape. It made her wide eyes glint for an instant. "I gave you power for a purpose, and that purpose is complete." She turned her hand over slowly and showed me something she held in it. A small metal spike, too large to be a needle, too small to be a nail. She walked closer to me, rolling the fine-pointed etcher between two fingers, and smiled. Her fingertips traced over my chest and ribs, and I shuddered. She'd carved the word weak upon my body in dozens of alphabets and hundreds of languages, etching it into my flesh, the palms of my hands, the soles of my feet, with miles upon miles of scars. I wanted it to be over. I wanted her to kill me. She leaned close to my face.
"Today," she breathed, "we start carving your teeth."
Cold enveloped me, and water slithered into my mouth, though I tried to keep it out. Some seeped through my cracked lips. More went up my nostrils and took the long way around, and then it froze into ice, slowly forcing my jaws apart. Mab leaned in close to me, lifting the etcher, and I caught the faint scent of oxidation as the instrument began scratching at my incisors. Oxidation. The smell of rust. Rust meant steel. Something no fairy I had ever seen, apart from Mother Winter, could touch. This wasn't actually happening to me. It wasn't real. The pain wasn't real. The tree wasn't real. The ice wasn't real. But I still felt them. I could feel something behind them, a will that was not my own, forcing the idea of pain upon me, the image of helplessness, the leaden fear, the bitter vitriol of despair. This was a psychic assault like nothing I'd ever seen before. The ones I'd felt before this one were feeble shadows by comparison. No, I thought.
No,
I moaned. And then I drew a deep breath. This was not how my life would end. This was not reality. I was Harry Dresden, Wizard of the White Council, Knight of Winter. I had faced demons and monsters, fought off fallen angels and werewolves, slugged it out with sorcerers and cults and freakish things that had no names. I had fought upon land and sea, in the skies above my city, in ancient ruins and in realms of the spirit most of humanity did not know existed. I bore scars that I'd earned in dozens of battles, made enemies out of nightmares, and laid low a dark empire for the sake of one little girl. And I would be damned if I was going to roll over for some punk outsider and his psychic haymaker. The words first. Damn near everything begins with words. I am, I breathed, and suddenly the ice was clear of my mouth. I am Harry, I panted, and the pain redoubled. And I laughed, as if some freak who had never loved enough to know loss could tell me about pain.
I am Harry Blackstone Copperfield Dresden,
I roared. Ice and wood shattered. Frozen stone cracked with a sound like a cannon's blast, a spiderweb of tiny crevices spreading out from me. The image of Mab flew away from me and blew into thousands of crystalline shards like a shattering stained glass window. The cold and the pain and the terror reeled away from me, like some vast and hungry beast suddenly struck on the nose. The outsiders loved their psychic assaults. And given that this one happened about 2 seconds after Sharkface came up out of the water, it was pretty clear who was behind this one. But that was fine. Sharkface had chosen a battle of the mind. So be it. My head, my rules. I lifted my right arm to the frozen sky and shouted, wordless and furious, and a bolt of scarlet lightning flashed from the seething skies. It smashed into my hand and then down into the earth. Frozen dirt sprayed everywhere, and when it had cleared, I stood holding an oaken quarterstaff, carved with runes and sigils, as tall as my temple and as big around as my joined thumb and forefinger. Then I stretched my left arm down to the earth and cried out again, sweeping it up in a single beckoning gesture. I tore metals from the ground beneath me, and they swirled like mist up around my body, forming into a suit of armor covered in spikes and protruding blades. Okay, big guy, I snarled out at the dark will that even now gathered itself to attack again. Now we know who I am. Let's see who you are. I took the staff and smote its end down on the ground.
Who are you?
I demanded.
You play in my head, you play by my rules. Identify yourself.
In answer, there was only a vast roaring sound, like an angry Arctic wind gathering into a gale.
Oh, no you don't, I muttered. You started this, creep. You want to get up close and personal? Let's play. Who are you?
A vast sound, like something you'd hear in the deep ocean, moaned through the sky.
Thrice I command thee,
I shouted. Focusing my will, sending it coursing into my voice, which boomed out over the landscape.
Thrice I bid thee. By my name I command thee. Tell me who you are.
And then a vast swirling form emerged from the clouds overhead. A face, but only in the broadest, roughest terms, like something a child would make from clay. Lightning burned far back in its eyes, and it spoke in the voice of gale winds.
I am Gatebreaker Harbinger. I am Fear-Giver Hope-Slayer. I am he who walks before.
For a second I just stood there, staring up at the sky, shocked. Hell's bells. It worked. The thing spoke, and as it did, I knew what it was. As if I'd been given a snapshot of its core identity, its quintessential self. For one second, no more than that, I understood it. What it was doing, what it wanted, what it planned, and then that moment was past. The knowledge vanished the way it had come, except for one thing. Somehow, I'd held on to a few crumbling fragments of insight. I knew the thing trying to tear my head apart was a walker. I didn't know much about them, except that nobody else knew much about them either, and that they were extremely bad news. And one of them had tried to kill me when I was 16 years old. He who walks behind had nearly done it. Except, from where I stood now, I wasn't sure he'd really been trying to kill me. He'd been shaping me. I don't know for what, but he'd been trying to provoke me. And this thing in my head, the thing I'd named Sharkface, was like him. A walker, a peer. It was huge, powerful, and in a way utterly different from the kinds of power I'd seen before. This thing wasn't bigger than Mab, but it was horribly, unbearably deeper than her, like a photograph of a sculpture compared to the sculpture itself. It had power at its command that was beyond anything I had seen, beyond measure, beyond comprehension, just plain beyond. This thing was power from the outside, and I was a grain of sand to its oncoming tide. But you know what? That grain of sand might be the last remnant of what had once been a mountain, but that which it is, it is. The tide comes and the tide goes. Let it hammer the grain of sand as it may. Let lofty mountains fear the slow, constant assault of the waters. Let the valleys shudder at the pitiless advance of ice. Let continents drown beneath the dark and rising tide. But that grain of sand, it isn't impressed. Let the tide roll in. The sand will still be there after it rolls out again. So I looked up at that face, and I laughed. I laughed scorn and defiance at that vast, swirling power, and it didn't just feel good. It felt right.
Go ahead,
I shouted.
Go ahead and eat me, and then we'll see if you've got the stomach to keep me down.
I lifted my staff, and golden white fire began to pour from the carved runes as I gathered power into it. The air grew chill with winter, and frost formed on the razor-edged blades in my armor. I ground my feet into place, setting them firm, and the glow of soul fire began to emanate from the cracks in the earth around me. I bared my teeth at the hungry sky, flew the bird at it with my free hand, and screamed,
"Bring it on!"
A vast and furious voice filled the air, a sound that shook the earth and sky alike, that made the ground buckle and the swirling clouds recoil. And then I was back on the Harley, clutching Karen's waist in one hand and clinging to the Winchester with the other. The motorcycle was still in motion, but it wasn't accelerating. It felt like we were coasting. Karen let out a low, gurgling cry and suddenly sagged forward, panting. I pulled her back against me, helping her to sit up, and after a few seconds she gave her head a few quick shakes and snarled, "I hate getting into a Vulcan mind meld." "It hit you too?" I asked. It... She cast a look over her shoulder up at me and shuddered. Yeah. You okay now? I'm starting to get angry, she said. A hideously mirthful sound spread over the air. The sound of the Earl King's laughter. His great steed swerved in close to the motorcycle, and he lifted his sword in a gesture of fierce defiance. Then his burning eyes turned to me, and he spoke in a voice that was murderously merry.
Well done, Starborn!
I said, thank you. The Lord of the Goblins laughed again. It was the kind of sound that would stick with you and wake you up in the middle of the night, wondering whether perhaps poisonous snakes had surrounded your bed and were about to start slithering in. I looked back. The hunt had spread out into a ragged semblance of its former cohesion, but even as I watched, the riders and hounds poured on extra effort to gather together again. I looked around, but saw no sign of Shark Face. I did see something else. V-shaped ripples coming toward us through the water. A whole lot of them.
Here they come!
I shouted to the Earl King.
Good hunting! That much seems certain,
he called in that same cheerfully vicious voice, and wheeled his horse to the right. Half of the riders and hounds split off with him, while the other half continued streaming after me. I pointed at our target as the Earl King headed toward his.
There,
I called.
Let's do it!
The Harley Tiger let out another snarling roar, and Karen raced toward the second barge. Hellish shrieks went up from both groups of the hunt, and the oncoming things in the water smoothly split into two elements as they came forward. We raced the enemy toward the barges. This time, we didn't have surprise on our side. It couldn't have been more than a minute or two since the hunt had announced its arrival, but I saw figures stirring on the deck of the barge ahead of us.
Gun!
Shouted Karen.
Incoming!
Crap. Out over the water like this, I didn't have access to anywhere near enough magic to provide a continuous shield. And I couldn't try to slap down individual bullets either. By the time I saw the gunfire, the round would already be going through us. Which meant that this was going to happen the vanilla way, the way soldiers worldwide have done it for a few centuries now. Advance, 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 and hope that you didn't get shot. Then Karen snatched the rifle out of my hand and screamed,
"Take the bike!"
I fumbled for a moment, but found the handlebars, reaching around her to make it happen. I gunned the throttle as Karen raised the Winchester to her shoulder, half rose, and squinted through the buckhorn sights. Flashes came from the boat, and something that sounded like an angry hornet flicked past my ear. I saw bits of spray coming up from the water ahead of us as the shooters misjudged their range, and I kept on racing straight ahead. When we got to within 100 yards, Karen started shooting. The old rifle boomed, and sparks flew up from the barge's hull. She worked the lever action without lowering it from her shoulder and fired again. One of the dark shapes on the deck vanished, and two more flinched away. More gunfire came from the boat, panic fire, splashing wildly everywhere and mostly nowhere close to us. Whoever was over there, they didn't like getting shot at any more than I did. As we closed the last yards, Karen fired 3 more times in a rapid, assured pace. I couldn't see whether she hit anyone until we went roaring past the barge, no more than 10 feet away, when a man holding a distinctive shape of a shotgun rose into sight. Karen was covering the barge's stern with the Winchester when he popped up. The old gun roared again, and the gunman fell away and out of sight. We raced by unharmed, but the enemy gunfire had done its work. The riders and hounds of the hunt had been distracted by the flying bullets, and they didn't do nearly as much damage to the barge as in the initial attack. Even as I watched, more and more figures with guns appeared on the barge and started shooting. I checked the oncoming rush of outsiders. We weren't going to sink the barge before they got here.
To sink it?
Karen was shouting.
What? We don't have to sink the barge,
she shouted.
It can't move on its own. We just have to kill the boat that's pulling it.
Right,
I said, and leaned the Harley into a turn that would take us arching back toward the barge. This time at its front, or prow, or bow or something, where a rig containing a tugboat a bit bigger than the water beetle had been built on. It also brought us closer to the oncoming outsiders, and I couldn't tell which of us would get there first. As I sped up, Karen dug into the compartments on the Harley, reaching around me, then said,
"Hold it steady!"
Then she stood up, and I couldn't see a damn thing. But I did see the way she pulled the pin out of a freaking hand grenade and let the spoon spin off into the night. The Harley buzzed past the tugboat's rig, maybe 10 feet ahead of the outsiders, and Karen gave the grenade a rather feeble little flick as we went by. I heard it smash into glass like a stone thrown against a window, and then we were past the barge, and a huge sound thudded through the air, like an entire library of books all dropped flat at the same instant, and an incandescent white light flared from the tug. I looked back over my shoulder and saw that the tugboat was on fire, pouring out thick black smoke and leaning sharply to one side. Murphy saw it too, and let out an ululating war cry before she sat back down and pushed my hands off the handlebars, reassuming control of the Harley.
"Two down," she said. "One to go."
I looked back behind me. The outsiders had begun swarming at the barge, and one of them actually came out of the water at one of the rearmost riders of the hunt. This horrible thing that was all pustules and multiple limbs with too many joints. As it leapt, the rider raised a shadowy bow and loosed a darkling arrow. It struck the outsider and burst into red amber flame, the same color as the burning eyes of the hunt. The outsider let out an unearthly wail and plunged back beneath the surface.
"Come on," I said to Karen. "Head for the other boat."
"Should we?" she asked. "That Earl King guy seems a little do-it-yourself-y." She was right about that. Like any of the other seriously powerful beings of Faerie, the Earl King had a strong sense of pride. And you crossed that pride at your own risk. If I showed up and the Earl King thought I was making the statement that I judged him unfit to finish the task, it could come back to haunt me. On the other hand, I'd already insulted him once, and there was a lot on the line. If he didn't want me making calls like this, he shouldn't have let me shoot him and take over his hunt, I said. I turned to beckon the riders and hounds behind me and shouted,
"Come on!"
My voice came out as both my own and in the howling screech of the hunt, the two interwoven, and the rest of my group joined in the shriek and formed up around the Harley as it raced across the water toward the third barge, where the fight wasn't going well. There were several long, straight streaks of molten steel where the Earl King and his riders had struck the barge's hull, the edges marked with flickering tongues of eerie green fire. But they had not torn a hole in it like we had the first barge either, and the outsiders had gotten to this barge faster than they had to mine. Even as we approached, I saw a racing hound of the hunt vanish in a spray of water as things, plural, too twisted and too confusing to count, surged up from below and began to drag the hound down. A shriek loud enough to cause spray to rise from the water shook the air, and the Earl King himself plunged down from overhead, leading a trio of hunters behind him. Blades and arrows struck down at the outsiders in plumes of ember fire. The Earl King seized the hound by the scruff of its neck and dragged it up out of the grasp of the creatures beneath the surface. The Earl King and his riders had fallen into a formation, a great tilted wheel. At the far end, the riders were maybe 50 feet above the waves, circling in the air to then charge down at the surface of the water where it met the hull of the barge. The outsiders would throw themselves up out of the waves, meeting each individual rider. Hounds would, in turn, try to throw themselves on the outsiders, smothering their defense so that the rider could strike the barge. Meanwhile, figures aboard the barge fired rifles wildly into the night, though the deck of the thing was actually bobbing with the thrashing of the outsiders and the water around it. Whoever they were, they struck me as amateurish, though maybe it was only because I'd been exposed to real soldiers before, who were a deadly threat even on the scale of supernatural conflict. These guys weren't the Einherjarin, Jaren, but at the end of the day, they still had deadly weapons, and more than one rider and hound had been struck by rounds and bled molten light from their shadow-masked bodies. The piercing screech of the hunt met with the howls of the outsiders and the crack of rifle fire, and bit by bit, the barge's hull bled red-hot steel. But it wasn't happening fast enough. With a groan, the barge's tugboat, this one mounted behind it, began shoving the thing forward through the water and toward the shore of Demon Reach. "I shouldn't have split us up," I said. "We didn't cover twice as many targets. We just got twice as half-assed." Karen made a sputtering sound, then said, "You and Math are not friends. Regret later. Lead now." "Right," I said. The barge wasn't exactly leaping into motion, but it wouldn't stop on a dime once it got moving, either. "Do you have any more grenades?" I asked Karen. "I used them a couple of weeks ago," she said. "With Kincaid?" I asked. There was an edge to it. She and the assassin were kind of an item the last time I looked. "Harry," she said, "focus." Hell's bells, she was right. I didn't need the winter mantle turning me into a territorial alpha dick right now. I stared at the barge for a long second, pushing that instinct away, and then said to the hunt, "Join the Earl King! Attack the barge!" Hounds and riders streamed past us, joining the madman's wheel of death in the sky, and I lowered my voice, speaking only to Karen, as I reloaded the Winchester. "Get me to the tugboat." She gave me a quick, wide-eyed glance, and then seemed to get it. She gunned the motor, sending the Harley shooting past the Earl King's very large, very threatening, and very distracting formation as we raced alone toward the chugging tugboat. She brought us right alongside it, and once again I leapt from the back of the Harley. I hit the side of the tug pretty hard, but managed to get the fingers of my left hand around the top of the rail, and with a few kicks managed to swing myself up onto the deck. I landed in a crouch, clutching the rifle, got my bearings, and headed toward a stairwell that would lead me to the boat's bridge. I went up it as quietly as I could, which is pretty damn quiet for a guy my size, Winchester at the ready. The bridge of the tug was big enough to merit its own enclosed space, and I slipped up to the door, took a breath, then ripped it open, lifting the Winchester as I did. The bridge was empty, the wheel secured with a pair of large plastic ties. There was a piece of paper taped to the wheel, and on it was written in large black marker, "Look behind you." I started to turn, but a cannonball hit me between the shoulder blades. I flew forward onto the bridge and slammed my head against the plexiglass forward windows. I fell back from that, stunned, and a heavy weight hit me from the side, slamming me into a bulkhead, which felt almost exactly like being slammed into a steel wall. I wound up prone, my face to the deck, and once more the heavy weight slammed into me, landing on my back. And Cat Sith, who had told me not to turn my back on anyone, purred,
"Wizard, knight, fool. Too ignorant even to know how to die properly."
His skin-crawling voice came out in a throaty buzz next to my ear.
"Allow me to educate you."
Chapter 44. The reasonable thing to do would have been to whimper or flinch or just freak out and look for the nearest exit. But instead of doing any of those things, I felt a chill settle over my brain, and a very cold, calm part of me studied the situation objectively.
"Join, hide, or die," I said.
I heard the faint echo of the wild hunt's screech in my voice.
"Excuse me," Cat Sith said.
"You have excellent hearing," I said, "but I will repeat myself. Join, hide, or die. You know the laws of the hunt."
"I do know them, wizard, And once I have slain you, the hunt will be mine to do with as I please.
The real Cat Sith wouldn't be having this conversation with me, you know. He'd have killed me by now. A blow struck the back of my head, sharp, painful, but not debilitating.
I am Cat Sith, the one, the only.
I turned my head slightly and said,
So why do I still have a spine?
And I threw an elbow at the weight on my back. I connected with something, hard, and slammed it off me. It hit the other wall of the bridge, and I flung myself to my feet in time to see the large, lean form of Cat Sith thrash his tail and bound at me. I ducked him, moving forward under his leap, and spun, and it left the two of us facing each other across the full length of the bridge. Slow, I said. I've seen him move. Cat Sith is faster than that. A hideous, snarling sound came from the form of the Malk.
I am he.
Give me a Coke, I snarled.
What?
You heard me, Mittens. Get me a freaking Coke and do it now. Sith remained in place, as if locked to the floor, though his whole body was quivering, his claws sheathing and unsheathing in rhythm. But he didn't fly at me, ripping and tearing, either. You see, I said, Cat Sith is a creature of faery, and he swore an oath to Queen Mab to obey her commands. She commanded him to obey mine. And I just gave you a command, Kitty. Did Mab release you from her command? Did she suspend the duties of her vassal? Sith snarled again, his eyes getting wider and rounder, his tail thrashing around wildly. They got to you, didn't they? I said. They jumped you back at the Botanic Gardens while you were covering my exit. Freakin' Sharkface was watching the whole thing, and he got you. Sith began quivering so hard that he was jitterbugging back and forth in place on the floor, his head twitching, his fur standing on end, and then abruptly lying flat again. Fight it, Sith, I urged him quietly. It doesn't have to win. Fight it. For a second I thought I saw something of Cat Sith's smug, contemptuous self-assurance on the Malk's face. And then it was gone. Just gone. Everything went away, and the Malk stood for a second with its head down. Then it lifted its head, and the motion was subtly wrong, something that simply didn't have the grace I'd seen in the Elder Malk before. It faced me for a moment, and then it spoke, its voice absent of anything like personality.
A pity. I would have been more useful to them as an active, covert asset.
I shuddered at the utter absence in that voice. I wasn't talking to Sith anymore. I was speaking with the adversary. Like Mab wouldn't have figured it out, I said. Like she did when you infected Leah.
Further conversation is not useful to our design,
Not Sith said. And then the Malk's form flew at me in a blur. It was a testament to the power of the Winter Knight's mantle and the Wild Hunt's energy that I survived that first leap at all. Sith struck straight at my throat. I got my arms in the way. The black shadow mask of the Hunt over my arms and chest blew apart into splinters, dispersing some of the impact energy of the Malk's spectacular leap, and instead of pulping me against the wall behind me, I just got slammed into it with tooth-rattling force. Sith bounced off me, which was what I had hoped would happen. In my line of work, I've dealt with more than one critter that is faster than fast. When they've got their feet underneath them, it's the next best thing to impossible to land anything on them. But when they're in the air, they're moving at the speed gravity and air resistance dictate, like everybody else. For that one portion of a second, Sith was an object moving through space, not a blindingly fast killing machine. Someone who didn't know that wouldn't have known to be ready for it. But I did, and I was. The blast of raw force I summoned wasn't my very best punch, but it was the best I was going to get out here over the lake. It slammed into the creature that had been Cat Sith and plowed it out through the plexiglass window. The plastic didn't break. It came entirely out of its housing, and the Malk and the slab of plexiglass the size of a door went whirling out into the madness of the night. Sith flew out over the bow of the tugboat and plunged down into the water through the open spaces of the pipe steel rig between it and the barge. I stared hard after the departed Malk for a few seconds, to be sure he wasn't going to bounce right back into my face somehow. As I did, I watched in the other half of the bridge's forward window while the shadow mask of the Hunt slithered back up over my arms and face. I gave it to a 3 count, nodded, and then went to the tug's wheel. I snapped the plastic ties, securing it with a pair of fast jerks, then started rolling the wheel as far as it would go to the right. There was a big lever that looked like a throttle, and when I pushed it forward, the boat's engine started to roar with effort. The barge groaned as the tug changed the direction in which it applied force, and the barge's back end began slowly slewing out and to the left. That drew shouts of consternation from the deck of the barge. I didn't feel like getting shot in the face, so I knelt down out of sight while I pulled the second-hand belt off of my old jeans and used it to secure the wheel in position. Then I recovered the Winchester and backed out of the bridge, hurrying away from it as quietly as I could. What I'd done was a delaying tactic at best. It wouldn't turn the barge around, but it would set it to spinning in place, and maybe cost the enemy time to turn it around if they took control of it again. But that was exactly what the Hunt needed to sink her. Time. The longer the barge played sit and spin, the better. So I found a nice quiet patch of shadow where I could see the stairs leading up to the tug's bridge and where I could stand behind a very large steel pipe. I rested the Winchester on the top bend of the pipe, sighted on the doorway, and waited. It didn't take long for the first couple of crewmen to arrive. I wasn't sure whether they came up from below decks or somehow swarmed over from the barge, but 2 men in dark clothing, carrying pistols at the ready, came hurrying along and started up the stairs. I'm not a great shot, but when you're resting a rifle on a solid surface, one that is perfectly still, at least relative to all the solid surfaces around it, and when the range is about 40 feet, you don't have to be an expert. You just have to take a breath, let it out, and squeeze. The Winchester cracked with thunder, and the first man arched into a bow of agony just as he reached the top of the stairs. That ended up working in my favor. He fell back into the second man, just as the second guy spun and raised his pistol. The first man fell into the second, sending his first shot wild, and knocked him about halfway over. The second man couldn't hold the gun with both hands, but he kept pulling the trigger as fast as he could. At 40 feet, terrified, in the dark, unsure of his target's exact location, and sprawled out with the dead weight of another man flopping against him, the poor bastard didn't have a chance. He got off 7 or 8 rounds, none of them coming anywhere close. I worked the action on the Winchester, took a breath, let half out, and squeezed the trigger. It wasn't until the flash of light from the shot illuminated him that I recognized Ace. His expression panicked. His gun aimed at a point 10 feet to my left. The light flashed and burned his face into my retina for a moment as the dark returned. And the tugboat was silent again. It didn't take long for the Earl King to finish his work. Maybe 3 minutes later, a chorus of hideous screams went up from the lake's surface, and the Hunt howled its triumph and circled into the sky, horns blaring, hounds baying. I saw a green fire burning fiercely from the spot the Hunt had started carving, and then the barge started to list toward that side as the water poured into her. Barges aren't warships or even maritime vessels. If they have below-deck spaces at all, they generally aren't fitted with flood compartments and sealable doors. They sure as hell don't have automatic systems. They're just soup bowls. Poke a hole in the bottom, and a bowl isn't going to hold much soup. I didn't feel like getting titanicked, so I hustled over to the spot where I'd boarded the tug. There was a roar from the Shadow Tiger mask around the Harley, and Murphy swept up alongside the boat. I leapt down onto the back of the bike in a single smooth motion, which I felt was cool, and landed with way too much of my weight on my genitals, which I felt was not. "Go, go, go!" I gasped in a pained falsetto, and Murphy peeled away from the doomed ships. Within moments, the hunt had fallen into formation around me again, and the Earl King was laughing maniacally, whirling his sword over his head. The shadow mask over one leg and a section of his ribs had been torn away, and I could see wounds beneath, but already the shadows were stretching over them again.
"I love nights like this,"
he bellowed.
"I love Halloween."
"Yeah, it's pretty badass,"
I said in my wobbling, creaky voice.
"Sir Knight," he said, "that was passably done. But from here, I believe it shall take more experience and expertise than you possess to continue the hunt. Do I have your leave to resume command and pursue these outsider vermin in a more appropriate fashion?" he asked me.
I squeaked. "You aren't going to come after me with it, are you?"
He broke into laughter that could have been heard for miles. He was smiling so hard it went right through the shadow mask, turning his face into a crazed jack-o'-lantern of soot and fire.
"Not this night. I give you my word. Have I your leave?"
Rather than answer the Earl King in my Mickey Mouse voice, I gave him the thumbs up. The Lord of the Goblins threw back his head and let out another screech, and his steed began to gain altitude. The rest of the hunt followed him.
Harry?
Karen said.
Yeah?
This is a motorcycle.
It didn't register for a second, and then I blinked. We were cruising down the surface of Lake Michigan, and it was chock full of monstery goodness, and we had just left the Wild Hunt.
"Oh, crap," I said. "Head for the island! Go, go, go!"
Murphy leaned hard into a turn and opened up the throttle. I looked over my shoulder at the Earl King, wheeling in the skies above the lake, spiraling higher and higher, the hunt following after. We went by a couple of Zodiacs so fast that their occupants didn't have time to shoot at us before we were gone. Then the motorcycle slowed.
"What are you doing?"
I screamed.
"We can't hit the beach at this speed,"
Karen shouted back.
"We'll pancake ourselves into those trees." "I don't really feel like taking a swim tonight." "Don't be such a pussy,"
Karen snapped. She leaned the bike into another turn, one that angled our direction to run parallel to the shore and cut out the accelerator. I felt the Harley slowing, and for a second I thought I felt it beginning to sink. Then the Earl King cried out again and dived, his horse sprinting straight down, trailing the fire of the hunt from its hooves. The rest of the hounds and riders followed in formation, and their horns and cries rebounded around the night. Then, maybe a second before they hit the water, the hunt changed. Suddenly the Earl King wasn't mounted on a horse, but on a freaking killer whale, its deadly-looking black-and-white coloration stark in the night. Behind him, the other steeds shifted too, their riders screeching with excitement. The hounds changed as well, their canine bodies compressed into the long, lean, powerful shape of large sharks. Then the whole lot of them hit the water in a geyser of spray, and the Harley promptly fell through the surface of the lake, and onto sand just under its surface. The bike slowed dramatically, pushing me up against Karen, nearly pushing her over the handlebars, but she locked her arms straight and held, drawing the bike up onto the shore of the island. She rode the brake until we'd come to a halt, about 5 feet short of hitting one of the big old trees on the island.
"See?"
Karen said.
"You were right," I said.
She looked back up at me, her eyes twinkling.
"You are so hot right now."
I burst out into a hiccuping laugh that felt like it could have veered off into manic or depressive at any second, the pressure and terror of this entire stupid, ugly day finally getting to me, but it didn't. There were no enemy ships right on hand, and no one had launched grenades at the island since the Wild Hunt's attack had begun. There might have been outsiders in the water, but apparently the hunt was occupying their total attention. For the moment, we were alone, and Karen started laughing too. We laughed like that for several moments. We each tried to speak, to say something about the day, but it kept getting choked off by the half-hysterical laughter.
"Grenades," I said, "as if a date has to have...
Look on Molly's face.
No, he's a dog, but I swear that...
Santa Claus smackdown,"
Murphy gasped finally, and it set us both into gales of laughter that had no wind to support them, until finally we were just sitting with her small, warm form leaning her back against my chest in the darkness. Then she turned her head slowly and looked up at me. Her eyes were very blue. Her mouth was very close. Then I noticed something. The second barge, whose tug Murphy had torched with her grenade, was moving. I stood up and climbed off the bike, my eyes widening. "Oh, crap," I said. From there, I could see that Shark Face stood calmly on the surface of the lake at the rear of the barge, his cloak twining and writhing all around him. His arms stretched forward in what was clearly a gesture of command. The waters at the rear of the barge boiled with outsiders, most of them at least partly out of the water, and it took me only a second to work out what was happening. They were doing an Evinrude impersonation, slamming their combined mass and preternatural strength against the rear of the barge. The burning tug was still a massive column of smoke and flame in front of the barge, but the barge was definitely moving, and it was close to shore. Eerie green and scarlet light flashed in the depths of the lake, soundless and random. Shark Face had been smart. When the hunt entered the water, he must have sent the lion's share of his outsiders against them, while he and a few others came back up to the surface to ruin the crap out of my potential romantic moment. "Oh, stars and stones," I breathed, "if they get that boat to shore."
"The Harley can't get us there," Karen said. "Not through this terrain and brush."
"You can't keep up with me here," I said. Murphy gritted her teeth at that, but nodded.
"Go," she said. "I'll come as fast as I can."
And then I thought to myself that if I kept on waiting for things to quiet down and be more appropriate and safer before I took action, I was never going to get anywhere in life. So I slipped a hand behind her head, leaned down, and kissed her on the mouth, hard. She didn't stiffen. She wasn't surprised. She leaned into it, and her mouth tasted like strawberries. I gave two heartbeats, three, four. Then we both drew away at the same time. Her eyes were slightly wide, her cheeks high with color. "I'm not going anywhere," I told her. Then I turned and sprinted toward the stretch of shore at which Shark Face had pointed the last barge. Chapter 45. For me, running across the island wasn't a physical effort. It was mostly a mental one. My awareness of the place was bone deep, a total knowledge that existed as a single whole body in my mind, a kind of understanding that some medieval scholars had called intellectus. It came to me on the level of reflex and instinct. When I ran, I knew where every branch stood out, where every stone lay ready to turn beneath my foot. Moving happened as naturally as breathing, and every step seemed to propel me forward a little faster, like running across the surface of one of those bouncy cages at a kid's pizza place. I didn't have to run across the island, I just had to think about it, and let my body effortlessly follow my mind. I came out of the woods on the beach above where the barge was headed, which was roughly 23 yards, 1 foot and 6.5 inches from the nearest edge of the What's Up dock. One of the three major pulsing ley lines ran out from the island at almost that exact point, and if the barge managed to ground itself in contact with the line, Chicagoans were going to have a really rough morning commute. Now that the hunt and the outsiders had taken their fight mostly below the waves, it was quiet enough to hear the barge approaching. Someone had already begun chanting on the deck of the barge. I couldn't see them through the smoldering wreckage of the tug out in front of the barge, but voices were certainly being raised in unison in a steady chant of some language that sounded as if it were meant to be spoken while gargling Crisco. "Whatever happened to Ia Ia Cthulhu Fatagan?" I muttered. "No one has a sense of style anymore." Behind the chanting, I could hear the bubbling, sloshing water as the outsiders pushed the barge nearer and nearer. I rested the butt of the rifle on the ground next to my foot, crouched down and squinted out at the boat. It was going to be here shortly, but not instantly, and I was pretty sure I'd get only one chance to stop it. I started gathering power to myself, an action I'd done so many times over the years that it was all but a reflex now, and squinted at the barge. If the ritual was already in progress, then there was a chance that they were simply in a holding pattern, holding up the skeleton of the spell with their own limited energy and waiting until the right moment. Once they were close enough to use it, they dropped their circle and channeled the energy of the ley line, shaping it into the spell's muscles and organs, filling out the frame that was prepared to accommodate it. I had to make sure they never got that chance. A hole in the hull would work, but by the time the barge came within my limited range, it would be too late to drown it. I'd already tried killing its engine once, so I wasn't terribly excited about the prospect of taking out the creatures pushing it. I had to stop it. "For destruction," I said aloud, "ice is also great and would suffice." I nodded once to myself, rose, and said, "Okay, Harry, get this one right." I went down to the shore. Using the butt of the rifle, I inscribed a circle in the mud and closed it with a touch of my hand and a whisper of will. Once I felt its presence snap into place, I took the will I'd been gathering, reached down into the earth, and gathered more, drawing it up like water from a well. I could feel the seething power of the ley line beneath me. Could feel how close I came to it in my quest to gather as much energy as I could before I unleashed my attack. The earth trembled with a subterranean river of dark power, the spirit of violence, havoc, and death expressed as energy, and if I tapped into it, I could potentially direct its terrible strength at the enemy. There would be consequences to an action like that, chain reactions and fallout I couldn't predict, but it would sure as hell get the job done. For a second, I almost did it. There was so much on the line. But you can't go around changing your definition of right and wrong, or smart and stupid, just because doing the wrong thing happens to be really convenient. Sometimes it isn't easy to be sane, smart, and responsible. Sometimes it sucks. Sucks wang, camel wang. But that doesn't turn wrong into right or stupid into smart. I had kinda gotten an object lesson in that, so I left that power alone. The magic continued to pour into me, more than I usually used, more than was comfortable. After 30 seconds I felt as if my hairs were standing on end and sparks were shooting between them. I ground my teeth, dug into the cold power of winter, and kept drawing more. I began directing it down toward my right hand, and cold, blue-white fire abruptly wreathed my fingers like the flame from a newly lit gas burner. The burned tug was only about 100 yards away when I lifted my hand, stepped forward out of the circle, and cried out,
"Rexus Mundus!"
And a globe of blindingly intense blue light the size of a soccer ball flew out into the night. It spewed mist from every inch of its surface and flashed through the night like a dying comet. It landed in the water 20 yards in front of the slow-moving barge. There was an abrupt screech as the sphere of condensed, absolute zero cold hit Lake Michigan. Ice formed almost instantly, and large crystals of it shot out in every direction, sharp as spears, kind of like Superman's Fortress of Solitude. One instant it was clear sailing for the barge, the next, the mutant spawn of an iceberg and a giant porcupine bobbed in the water directly in front of it, a barrier of ice the size of a tractor trailer. I could have gone bigger, but there just wasn't enough time. I needed it to happen fast to get that weight into position, but I wasn't a complete dummy. My pointy iceberg was the size of a semi, but the barge could have carried 20 of them. I just had to get the first piece into the right spot. Again I reached for Winter, and again I lifted my hand, howling,
"In Friga!"
Pure cold screamed from my hand into the air, spreading over the surface of the lake in a field shaped like a folding fan. The surface crystallized and froze, and I poured more and more into it, thickening the ice, spreading it toward the little iceberg. The wreckage of the tugboat hit my obstacle first, and the spears of ice punched through the weakened wooden hull of the tug, nailing the iceberg to it. The barge slowed, and pieces of the tug's rig screamed and bent in protest. Then, as it kept coming, it started hitting the thinnest ice at the edge of the fan. But as it kept coming, the ice got thicker and thicker, providing increasing resistance to the barge's forward motion. It began to grind to a halt. A furious shriek ripped the air. Shark face. I just pissed the walker off big time. It probably says something about my maturity level that it made me grin from ear to ear. I saw him jump into the air. Not like a bunny hop, but a full-on kung fu theater leap, way up over the barge. His rag-strip cloak spread out like dozens of little wings as gravity turned his jump from an ascent into a dive. I was starting to feel the effort of using so much brute power magic in such a short amount of time, but I had enough left to handle this thing. I prepared a blast of force, ready to swat him away from my barrier of ice and unleash it on him the moment he came within range. I missed. Well, I didn't miss, exactly. But just before the bolt slammed home, Sharkface split into dozens of identical shapes that splintered off in every direction. So one of those shapes got hit with a slap of force that would have rocked a car up onto two wheels, and that one went soaring away. But the other 40 or 50 crashed down onto my field of ice like cannonballs, smashing through in most places, in some only sending wide cracks through the ice. When that happened, the copies of Sharkface just started tearing it apart with their claws. Thick ice is no joke as an obstacle. Unless you're a walker of the outside, I guess, because these things ripped it apart like it was styrofoam. There were so damn many of them. I started slamming more of them, but it was heavy work, and there were just too many targets. While some of them ripped apart the remaining ice, others began to tear apart the iceberg and the tugboat, rending them into scrap with an inexorable strength and claws like steel knives. I might have hit 7 or 8 of them, but it just didn't matter. I was the wrong tool for the job, so to speak. This was a much larger problem, and I had no idea how to solve it. The chanting on the barge rolled upward an octave, gaining frenzied volume. Outsiders thrashed through the water, pushing the barge, surging ahead of it to push pulverized chunks of ice out of its way, their howls and weird clicks and ululations like their own horrible music. Other outsiders came rushing toward me on the shore, only to smash uselessly against the glowing barrier of Demon Reach's curtain wall. They couldn't get to me, which seemed fair enough because I couldn't seem to get to them either. I'd slowed them down, cost them maybe a couple of minutes, and that was all. The water near me stirred, and then a shark face rose up out of it, as if on an elevator, slow. His mouth tilted into a small smile. He stood there on the water, perhaps 5 feet away from me. His eyeless face looked smug.
"Warden," he said.
"Asshat," I replied. That only made his smile wider.
"The battle is over. You have failed. But you need not be destroyed this day."
"You're kidding," I said. "You're trying to recruit me?"
"The offer is made," the walker said. "We always appreciate new talent."
"I'm no one's puppet," I said. The walker actually barked out a short laugh.
"At what point have you been anything else?"
"You can forget it," I said. "I'm not working for you."
"Then a truce,"
Sharkface said.
We do not need you to fight our battles for us. But if you stand aside, we will accord you respect and leave you in peace. You and those you love, take them to a safe, quiet place. Stay there. You will not be molested.
My boss might not go along with this plan, I said.
After tonight,